The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and the first article will be an article on periodontitis. This is coming from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of November 2023. You've dutifully arrived for your regular dental checkup, and the dental hygienist is once again poking your gums and spouting off a list of numbers. 113-213-233. Although these numbers may seem mysterious, your hygienist is performing an essential check, measuring the depth of the pockets between your gums and teeth. Any measurements between 1 and 3 millimeters are considered healthy. Pockets 4 millimeters or deeper may be concerning because they can provide an all-too-hospitable hideout for plaque, tartar, and bacteria that can eat away at your tissues and teeth. These deep pockets can be a sign of a type of serious gum and bone disease called periodontitis. Regular oral hygiene, like brushing and flossing, helps to keep your gums healthy. So can dental checkups. But a lapse in these habits can make you more likely to develop diseases of the gum and bone, which can ultimately lead to tooth loss or surgery. Healthy gums are firm and snug against the teeth. Though you may have heard that healthy gums are pink, that's not always true. The color varies and can include dark pink and brown shades. But when plaque forms on your teeth, it can set off a harmful chain reaction. Here's a look at the progression. First of all, plaque forms. Certain foods, especially sugary sweets, can interact with bacteria in your mouth to form a harmful, sticky bacterial film called plaque. Brushing and flossing can remove the plaque, as well as food and bacteria that haven't yet turned into plaque. Plaque can turn into tartar. If you don't successfully remove plaque, it calcifies and it's more difficult to remove tartar. Tartar also contains bacteria and is harmful to your teeth. At this point, standard brushing won't cut it. You'll need a professional dental cleaning. Now, plaque and tartar can cause gingivitis. Plaque and tartar can cause gum tissue to become inflamed and swollen, which can result in gingivitis. This is the earliest form of gum disease. At this point, gums may look dark and puffy, feel tender, and bleed when you brush your teeth or floss, or when a dental professional uses a tool to probe your gums. Unfortunately, it's tough to avoid gingivitis, and many adults have at least some. But improving your oral hygiene can help to resolve mild forms of gingivitis. Gingivitis, unfortunately, can progress to periodontitis. If gingivitis is not treated, bacteria can migrate toward the roots and damage the supporting tissue and bone holding the teeth in place, called alveolar bone. This disease is known as periodontitis. It can create deep pockets between your gums and teeth. The pockets also host bacteria, which can worsen the problem. The destruction of the alveolar bone and tissue holding your teeth in place can result in teeth loosening or falling out. X-rays will show alveolar bone loss. Gingivitis and periodontitis can lead to problems elsewhere in your body. Your oral health is important to your overall health. It's not always clear how the two affect each other, but periodontal disease has been connected with a wide variety of health conditions, including cardiovascular disease, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, dementia, and chronic lung disease. Periodontal disease may increase the risk of or worsen these conditions. This could possibly be because gingivitis and periodontitis cause inflammation, or because bacteria from the mouth can get into the bloodstream. To prevent this progression, brush your teeth 2 minutes twice a day, floss once a day, and have routine dental appointments. Although good oral hygiene and regular dental cleanings and checkups play a big role in oral health, they're not the only important factors. It's also important to be aware of risk factors, some of which you may be able to address. You're at higher risk of gum problems if you smoke. Smoking makes you more prone to many diseases, including gum disease, or if you have a dry mouth. Saliva washes away food from your teeth and gums and defends the teeth from destructive acid and bacteria. Many adults experience dry mouth, sometimes due to a medical condition like Sjögren's syndrome or side effects from certain medications. You can have gum problems if you have certain medical conditions as well. As noted earlier, there is a complex relationship between oral health and overall health. Having diabetes or other health conditions may increase the risk of periodontal disease. Also, if you take certain medications, some medications can cause your gums to grow too much, a phenomenon called gingival overgrowth. This overgrowth covers too much of your teeth and hosts bacterial growth that can lead to gum disease. Gingival overgrowth can occur because of the immunosuppressant cyclosporin, the anti-seizure drug phenytoin, that's another name for Dilantin, and some calcium channel blockers. Sometimes stopping the drug reverses the growth. Other times the extra gum tissue has to be surgically removed. If you fall into one of these higher risk categories, you may need to see your dentist more often than once or twice a year. You also may need to be referred to a specialist called a periodontist. If you smoke, connect with your healthcare team about resources to quit. Your care team also may be able to help treat dry mouth, which may include changing problem-causing medications. If your gingivitis ultimately progresses to periodontitis, you'll need professional help to get your mouth back on track. For less severe periodontitis, treatments include scaling and root planting. Scaling is when a dental professional removes plaque and tartar from your teeth with a dental instrument, a laser, or an ultrasonic device. Scaling is done routinely at regular dental appointments. You may think of it as the scraping portion. It can be very tricky to remove plaque and tartar below the gum line and in the gum pockets. It may require specialized techniques. Root planing smooths down the surfaces of the tooth roots, removes bacteria and tartar, and encourages your gum to reconnect to the teeth. Your dentist may place an antibiotic in the gum pocket. If the pockets between your gums and teeth become too deep, then additional advanced treatment may be required. This might include flap surgery. In this surgery, the periodontist cuts into the gums to access the root surface. This allows for more in-depth cleaning than regular scaling and root planing. The periodontist may rebuild or reshape damaged alveolar bone. Then the gum tissue is stitched back into place in a way that decreases the size of the pockets between the teeth and gums. When you have periodontitis, your gums can pull away from your teeth, exposing the roots of your teeth. To protect your roots and reduce further gum loss, a surgeon may take a small amount of tissue from a donor or elsewhere in your mouth, like the roof of your mouth, and stitch it into your gums. Bone grafting. If periodontitis has damaged the alveolar bone, a surgeon can place a small amount of natural or artificial bone in its place. This serves as a platform for bone growth. In an alternative procedure called guided tissue regeneration, a dental professional places a barrier between the bone socket and the tooth. This prevents tissue from growing in that space, allowing the alveolar bone surrounding the teeth to regrow. The article goes on to ask, should I use a water flosser? Though it only takes a few minutes, flossing removes a dreaded task for many people. Today, there are many products aimed to make flossing easier, like floss holders, intradental brushes, and water flossers. The goal of flossing is to remove food and plaque in tight spaces between the teeth that your toothbrush can't access. A water flosser, also called a dental water jet, uses a stream of water to blast away debris. Several water flossers have been deemed effective at removing plaque and helping to prevent gingivitis. Water flossers may be especially helpful for people who have trouble flossing by hand or who have orthodontia or dental work that makes it hard to use standard dental floss. Your dentist can help you decide what flossing tools are best for your needs. Be sure not to share your water flosser with others in your household, as you risk bacterial contamination. Now here's a couple of short articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. Again, this is the November 2023 letter. The first one is entitled, Menopausal Hormone Therapy and Dementia Link is Unproved. Menopausal hormone therapy, which includes estrogen and sometimes progestin, is an effective treatment for vasomotor symptoms. The clinical name for the hot flashes and night sweats of menopause. It also prevents bone loss and can help relieve menopausal vaginal symptoms. Many people still believe that menopausal hormone therapy is unsafe and are not willing to use it. It's true that menopausal hormone therapy has risks, and certain people are not candidates, like those with a history of certain cancers. Some fears about menopausal hormone therapy are based on outdated, misunderstood, or conflicting research, leading some women to miss out on a potentially helpful treatment. A recent study published by the British Medical Journal adds concern about menopausal hormone therapy. This large Danish study found that women who received menopausal hormone therapy with estrogen and progestin were at higher risk of dementia than were women who did not receive hormone therapy. This was true even if they received hormone therapy only at age 55 and younger, or only used it for a year or less. Longer menopausal hormone therapy use was associated with a higher risk. Mayo Clinic experts point out that this study does not prove that menopausal hormone therapy causes dementia. Several factors complicate the issue. First, this was an observational study rather than a randomized controlled trial. The study found that very little exposure to menopausal hormone therapy during midlife was associated with dementia risk. But Mayo Clinic experts say that this association isn't biologically likely based on what researchers know about how dementia develops. Researchers will continue to explore menopausal hormone therapy and its possible risks and benefits. If you've already used menopausal hormone therapy, this shouldn't cause you to worry. If you're considering menopausal hormone therapy, discuss any questions or concerns with your healthcare team. And then here's another short article. Exercise could possibly help prevent Parkinson's disease in women. Parkinson's disease is a nervous system disorder that can cause progressive movement problems. It's estimated to affect about 1 million people in the United States. Because the cause isn't yet fully understood, there are no proven ways to prevent it. Studies have suggested that physical activity may help decrease the risk of Parkinson's disease. But this has been difficult to prove, partially because people may experience some symptoms years before a Parkinson's diagnosis. These earlier symptoms can include sleep disorders, depression, anxiety, and movement problems like tremor, stiff muscles, and balance problems. These type of symptoms could lead people to exercise less, so it's hard to know if the decrease in exercise is a contributor or an effect of the disease. A recent large study of almost 100,000 French women published in Neurology set out to clarify this confusion. The study followed the women for 30 years, repeatedly surveyed them about their physical activity levels, and monitored them for the development of Parkinson's. The analysis excluded women who developed Parkinson's in the first 10 years of the study in case early symptoms affected their activity levels before a formal Parkinson's diagnosis. The study associated physical activity with a decreased risk of Parkinson's. The most active participants were 25% less likely to develop Parkinson's than those with the least physical activity. Exercise also has important benefits for people already diagnosed with Parkinson's. Previous research found that people with Parkinson's who exercise for 2.5 hours a week or more had better mobility and quality of life. In addition, exercise can increase muscle strength, flexibility and balance, and reduce depression and anxiety in those with and without Parkinson's. These results provide another possible reason to get serious about regular physical activity. Now, here's a really interesting article in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. It's called Depression's New Directions: Faster, More Effective Relief. Depression is often misunderstood as temporary feelings of distress or sadness. Phrases like, "I'm feeling stressed," or "I'm having a rough week," while not to be dismissed, are not typical descriptions of how depression feels. Those who have depression feel dark and hopeless, like being at the bottom of a well and seeing no way out. Those feelings can quickly escalate and affect your ability to work, to hold relationships, and even to stay alive. This mental health condition is relatively common, affecting 10% of Americans every year. Depression can be difficult to treat because it involves the complex workings of the brain. What's effective for one person may not work for another. In recent years, researchers have tested a number of new treatments that show promise for improving depression when other treatments aren't working. Currently, two classes of drugs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, and the serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, SNRIs, are typically recommended as first treatment for depression. They're often paired with cognitive behavioral therapy, a form of therapy in which people learn skills to manage symptoms of depression. SSRIs and SNRIs impact neurotransmitters, chemical messengers used to communicate between brain cells. In particular, these drugs affect neurotransmitters that regulate mood. SSRIs and SNRIs control and manage the symptoms of depression for many people, especially when paired with therapy sessions and lifestyle strategies. But these medications come with significant drawbacks, including effectiveness. Some people don't see much relief after taking these drugs. About 1/3 to 1/2 of people with severe depression or major depressive disorder don't get any relief with SSRIs or SNRIs. If they do not see symptom improvement after trying two different medications over several weeks, they're considered to have treatment-resistant depression. Another drawback is time. The drugs don't reach full effectiveness until a month or longer after taking the first dose. That means people having a psychological crisis have to find other ways to manage until the drugs start working. Then there are side effects. Antidepressants can cause side effects including nausea, headaches, and sleep problems. In the long term, sexual dysfunction, including loss of libido, is fairly common. So there are some new approaches that may give faster results. Treatments that aim to improve upon those drug shortcomings have recently been approved. The most promising new antidepressant treatments come from the class of drugs called N-methyl-D-aspartate, or NMDA, receptor antagonists. The effect they have in the brain is different from that of other antidepressants. For example, SSRIs work by increasing the availability of serotonin, a neurotransmitter connected to mood. Drugs in the NMDA class, on the other hand, act on a pathway in the brain that affects glutamate. Glutamate is a neurotransmitter important for processing information. People with depression often don't have as many connections, called synapses, between brain cells, which may contribute to an increase in depression symptoms. These drugs create more of these connections, which may ease symptoms. Here's a couple of examples. The first one is esketamine, or Spravato, which is a fast-acting antidepressant that was approved in 2019 for people with treatment-resistant depression. It's given as a nasal spray, so it enters the bloodstream and reaches the brain much faster than an oral medication would. That swift delivery can ease depression symptoms within several hours. There can be significant relief in a day, but their effect seems to wear off quickly, with some studies showing a dose loses effectiveness within a week. The drug is to be taken in conjunction with an oral antidepressant. Esketamine at this time can only be given in a clinical setting under the supervision of a healthcare professional. That's primarily because of a potential side effect, including prolonged sedation and distortion of perceptions like time and space. Also, research still is needed to determine how long a person can take esketamine safely. Standard dosing involves taking the medication twice a week for 4 weeks, then once a week for 4 weeks, and then tapering further as the care team recommends. Esketamine's long-term effectiveness is not clear, and long-term side effects are not yet well understood. Short-term, the side effects can include blurred vision, dizziness, drowsiness, nausea, vomiting, and higher blood pressure. Another drug that is used is dextromethorphan bupropion. The combination drug dextromethorphan bupropion, which is called Auvelity, was approved by the FDA for major depression in 2022. Dextromethorphan is a common cough suppressant with some effectiveness against depression, and bupropion is a common antidepressant. It's a tablet taking twice a day. Like esketamine, dextromethorphan bupropion reduces symptoms of depression quickly in 1 to 2 weeks, and reaches maximum effectiveness in 4 to 6 weeks. Unlike esketamine, the prescription drug can be taken at home. In clinical trials, the most common side effect of the Auvelity were dizziness, nausea, diarrhea, headache, drowsiness, and dry mouth. 2 in 3 people report side effects. Then there are non-drug treatments. A procedure called repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, RTMS, was approved by the FDA to treat depression in 2008. It was later approved to treat headache-related pain and in 2018 to treat obsessive-compulsive disorder. The treatment uses magnetic fields to stimulate nerve cells in the brain to improve symptoms of depression. An electromagnetic coil is placed against the scalp near the forehead. The magnet creates electric currents that stimulate nerve cells in the region of the brain involved in mood control and depression. Treatment is typically delivered in rapid bursts during 30-minute sessions, often over the course of several weeks. The benefits of RTMS for depression don't appear to be as strong as those of some other treatments, but RTMS does ease symptoms to some extent. Some studies have suggested that the benefit lasts at least a year in about half of the people who receive it. This therapy causes few or no serious side effects in most people. It's also seen as a promising treatment for older adults who are more likely to be taking medications that can interact with antidepressants. And the article goes on to say that with a therapy called repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, an electromagnetic coil is placed on the head and daily stimulations of about 30 minutes are given over several weeks. The magnet creates electric currents that stimulate nerve cells in the region of the brain involved in mood control and in depression. And there's a picture in the article that shows the magnet producing brain stimulations. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.